Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Robert Hansen talks about the Hong Kong National Party and why it looks as if, just as it's begun, it's about to be banned. And if Americans knew, Alison Weir explains the long relationship between the US and Israel. She's an author of the book Against Our Better Judgment. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Robert Hansen. I live in Hong Kong. I've been living here, getting on for 10 years. Background in England was barrister. In Hong Kong, I run a firm that sort of helps barristers from London gain access to the Hong Kong market.
So, is the legal system the same? Obviously, it's a former colony. What's the difference between UK and the Hong Kong legal system?
They are virtually the same. There are minor differences, but they are pretty much...
And how about Hong Kong and China? Are they similar?
They're different. You see, China has a civil law system, and Hong Kong has a common law system. Common law system is just like the UK system, which is judge-made law. So it's a mixture of statutes, stuff that you pass in Parliament, and you can refer to judicial decisions, and that's how Hong Kong works. Under a civil law system, which the European Union has and China has, it's all statute-based as opposed to judge-based law.
So you can't refer back and say, hang on a minute, this judgment went this way, and that be used in court afterwards?
It's not really. I mean, you would just really refer to the statute all the time. And the statute, the law, is supposed to cover every single situation, so there is no flexibility.
Well, that sounds almost impossible.
It is. I mean, this is why the European Union is probably in quite a bit of a mess as well with its legal system. And that's why you have pages and pages of laws that are very difficult to cover.
Anyway, Robert, can you just bring us up to date with what's happening with Hong Kong? Because I think it was 1998. Apparently, Hong Kong was handed over to China, only it wasn't quite. There was going to be another 50 years. So by my calculations, that's 2048. Was going to be no, apparently, and I don't know if this is true or not, you better inform us, no interference in Hong Kong affairs by China up until 2048. And then the Chinese would really start taking over. So you're on this path. I just wonder, if you could just explain to us what that means and how accurate my assessment there was for Hong Kong people.
It's fairly accurate. Just one point, it was 1997 that the 1st of July was the handover, and the last governor was Chris Patten. And at that point in Hong Kong, there was no democracy at all in Hong Kong. It was a colony and you had a governor, so there was no democracy. And the person that actually wanted democracy in Hong Kong was Chris Patten. Many people, particularly perhaps the Communist Party, were suspicious about this because they viewed this democratic movement as a way of unseating the Communist Party. But since 1997, for the next 50 years, Hong Kong will retain its status as a capitalist economy. So it won't be a communist economy, it will be a capitalist economy under the principle of one country, two systems.
Okay, and what does that mean in regards to things like police, armed forces, that kind of thing?
What it means is that when it comes to national security, it's one country. When it comes to trade, local legislation, the way things are done, the culture of Hong Kong, that's two systems, which means Hong Kong has its own legal system, its own way of doing business, which is different than China. But when it comes to national security, China is saying, no way, Jose, are you ever going to separate from
China? Okay, so does that mean you've got Chinese troops running around in Hong Kong?
We don't see them, but there are Chinese garrisons in Hong Kong.
Do they come out or much? I wonder what it's like. Yeah. Chinese ships, that sort of thing, naval ships?
Naval ships patrol the South China Sea, and there are helicopters flying over occasionally, but it's not immediate and it's not apparent. For example, in 2014, we had the Occupy Central movement, and that was when students and many people occupied all the streets from Central to Admiralty. That's a good half a mile. A lot of real estate. Many, many people just took over all the main roads, all the dual carriageways, put tents on the roads, and they occupied that for approximately 3 months, from September to December. And that was dispersed by the police and by the Hong Kong judiciary, and the Chinese army not involved at all. It was probably one of the most peaceful protests ever. I walked there quite a few times. It was amazing to be able to walk from Central to Admiralty. It's about a 10-minute walk maximum. And all that you saw was students in tents, and they were doing homework. I mean, we are talking so incredibly well-behaved. Students at night, literally doing homework, studying, a few people singing songs around a guitar. There was absolutely no trouble whatsoever.
Fascinating. Look, what was the reason for that then, particularly?
The reason for the protest was that Hong Kong wanted to have something called universal suffrage within this sort of 50-year period. And they were promised it for the at different times, and it didn't happen in the last round of elections. And so they said, delay's too much. We're going to protest because we want to have this thing called universal suffrage. Because at the moment, the chief executive of Hong Kong, it's currently somebody called Carrie Lam, she's only elected by a very small number of people. For example, I can't vote. Most people can't vote. You either have to be, in order to vote, an elected member of parliament, or representing a particular trade organization. So ordinary people can't vote for the chief executive, but they can vote for members of parliament. So in a sense, we do have a certain amount of democracy in terms of you can elect members of parliament and local councillors, but you just can't directly vote for the chief executive.
Now, I know you've in your parliament, you've got a limited amount of democracy. You've got a kind of pro-establishment parties, and you've got pro-democracy parties, middle class and upper class. But we've recently seen a splitting away of something new called the Hong Kong National Party, and the authorities are not happy, are they? What's going on with them? Why has the Hong Kong National Party decided it wants to split or form? And why is the government there saying it shouldn't be able to? Where are we at with this?
Okay. The Hong Kong National Party essentially wants to wants Hong Kong to be separate from mainland China. And this goes against what is the basic law, which upon handover stated that Hong Kong would always remain part of China. But a lot of the younger students are annoyed with the way Hong Kong's been run, annoyed that they haven't got universal suffrage so they can vote for the chief executive, and said, hey, the only way forward is to separate Hong Kong from mainland China.
Well, it sounds to me like a bit of a ticking time bomb, possibly. I know one of the reasons for this is this social credit system that the Chinese have just introduced. Can you tell us about that? Because this is, I think, one of the things which is really scaring people in Hong Kong, saying, well, okay, China's taking us over, but we don't want to have a seriously authoritarian system. And this does have the hallmarks of that.
A social credit system is, if you do minor things wrong, you get points. But like in a car, if you do minor driving offences, you might get 3 points, 4 points, or 5 points. And when you get to a certain level of points, you get banned from doing certain activities. So if, for example, you cross the road at a point where you have those green men crossings, pelican crossings, and it's on red, and you cross on red, you'll get a few negative points. And if you do that enough times, you get suspended from travelling for a certain period of time. So it's bad social behaviour.
So does that mean people wouldn't be able to go to work, for example?
They'd be able to travel locally. They wouldn't be able to sort of travel say, between different Chinese state. And I suppose ultimately, if they're banned from traveling, yeah, they would have to walk to work or
cycle.
Life gets very difficult. It's,
well, can they cycle?
Yeah. Can they cycle? Gosh.
Yes, that's a difficult one, isn't it? But I mean,
difficult one for me, that, isn't it? Because the way travel's going, more people having these electronic travel, like an octopus. I think you have them in England. They're not called
the Oyster cards they have in London. They've got the octopus in Hong Kong, haven't they? And actually, yeah, the public transport is incredibly efficient in Hong Kong. It's very fast. It's very cheap. And even the ferries, you know, fantastic. But so you would be potentially would be denied that in the long term in Hong Kong, although that, and they're starting to do that in China now. So can you get positive points, or is this just, you know, the system sounds very strange? You know, like if you say something nice about the government, you might get positive points. And if you say something bad about them, you get negative points. This is starting to be almost a sort of form of government imposed apartheid.
If you do good things for the government, you get rewards, but it's not obvious rewards. If you, you know, say nice things about the party or help the party in some way, you'll receive subtle forms of help. You get to meet important people, develop important business contacts, and it's up to you what you do with them.
I mean, that seems to be the way the establishment works all over the world, though.
It is. I mean, I will give you a couple of quotes from the South China Morning Post, because I one of the old-fashioned people actually cuts out clippings from newspapers. And this is kind of rare because it doesn't happen. That's why I kept these two. And this is from 17th of September 2015. And it's about Lee Ka-sing, one of Asia's richest people, I think the 23rd richest man in the world. And the South China Morning Post makes this point. It said, Lee enjoyed a great run in mainland markets in the past decades, largely because Beijing gave him preferential treatment. And then a few days later, on the 20th of September, they also wrote, this is the Beijing government, said that Lee had not grown rich from a level playing field in a market economy, but owed his success to his connections with top officials who gave him access to prime locations, often at hugely discounted prices. So that's how it works. I suppose this is what you call the positive credit.
Just characterise for us, if you can, this new Hong Kong National Party, and what's the debate like in Hong Kong about whether it's going to be allowed to continue or whether it's going to be banned?
It's got 21 days, I think, from yesterday to oppose a potential banning. In Hong Kong, just to briefly cap the law, there's something called Article 23, which is part of the Hong Kong Basic Law, and it was accepted at the point of handover and remaining force for 50 years. Article 23 has not been enacted yet, but that's the key piece of legislation that bans sedition, i.e. the separation of Hong Kong from mainland China. But because it's not been enforced, what the government is using, it's using an ordinance, a different ordinance, to ban this party and to stop party, just under more general laws. That's how it's working.
So the thing is, I mean, for example, in the future, if, say, a vast majority of people from Hong Kong decided they actually didn't want and didn't like being part of China and wanted to leave, a little bit like, say, for example, we had the vote in Scotland to leave the United Kingdom, or in Catalonia to leave Spain, then that simply would be considered a seditious act, and people who were trying to organise such a referendum would be criminalised.
They would be criminalised and put in prison, yeah. If anyone goes anywhere near separation, that's the red line. That's absolutely, definitely a non-starter.
I mean, what do people like yourself, I mean, you're UK born, but people who are Anglophiles make of the slow road towards China taking over Hong Kong then?
I think quite a lot of people want to get wealth, their personal wealth, out of Hong Kong. And actually quite a lot of wealthy people want to get their wealth out of China as well. That takes me on to another very interesting slight topic. And that is, in the Hong Kong press, there's always property, overseas property advertised. It used to be mainly London, still is, but also places like Birmingham and Manchester. And I was reading in the weekend Financial Times that Birmingham and Manchester have experienced the highest house price increases in the UK by quite a substantial margin. And a lot of that demand has come from places like Hong Kong and China, where the property is being sold as investment property. So there's people wanting to move money out of Hong Kong and China into places they perceive.
I mean, Robert, do people that you know, are they making plans to leave or not?
A lot of people have dual passports. So if things got bad, you could just leave at any time. So are they planning to leave? A few people have left that I've known, yes. But other people are just quite happy and just carrying on as normal. But if you've got a dual passport, whether it be a Canadian passport or a British passport or a New Zealand passport, you don't have to worry too much, because if it does get bad, you can just leave.
What about the growth of technology? I know that you were concerned about that just recently with the imposition of a rollout of 5G and smart meters. We've seen a similar sort of thing going on here in the UK, but what's happening in Hong Kong?
Hong Kong, nothing seemed to be happening until quite recently. And then I was absolutely horrified to read that in the newspaper now, smart meters are going to be in every apartment within 5 years' time.
And well, that's what they said here. It isn't happening.
Well, back to the quotes I read out about this Lee Kar Sing, he owns, essentially, the Hong Kong Telecom, well, his company does, and he owns a lot of the management companies that manage property, and he builds most of the Hong Kong properties. So, back to the point I was making about positive credits. If, as these articles suggest, he owes the mainland and the Hong Kong government favours, and they say to him, hey, Mr. Lee, make sure you have 5G, make sure these smart meters are installed, they will be installed. I have no doubts about that.
And what are your concerns about those technologies?
My concerns about it are because I have problems with certain like LED lights and CFL lights. I don't like the radiation from those. If I use a mobile phone, my head gets warm, so I don't like mobile phones. And the idea of having similar radiation or more powerful radiation close by, I just don't want it. That's because I think it will have a negative impact on my health. And I'm also concerned that the media is just not covering any downsides to 5G and smart cities. The media is almost acting like sales agents for the government on this issue.
I mean, isn't this a technology which is in a way inevitable, that that you're going to have this Internet of Things where everything is interconnected to everything else via a kind of data, mobile data networks, and via Wi-Fi?
People have survived a long time without it, and things seem to work pretty well without it. And I actually find the more mobile technology people have, it just tends to create more problems. If I wanted to go out with friends long before mobile phones came along, we'd just say, see you next Thursday, and everybody would be there next Thursday. Now you've got this thing called a mobile phone. People text, hey, can we make it a different day? Hey, can we make it a bit later? Hey, how about changing the place? And it seems to be more, less helpful than ever before. I don't find it useful at a personal level. And a bigger fear is that once all data is concentrated in one place, just think 1984, Winston Smith, you can rewrite history. You can create whatever you want. You can create whatever truth you want that's going to be on your mobile phone and on your computer, because whoever controls that computer and the mobile phone controls what you read. And what you read is the truth as the controller of that data wants you to see it.
Yeah,
I think
well,
that's a big problem.
It is, isn't it? I mean, especially with the consolidation of the press, into fewer and fewer hands all the time. Also, what about electronic cash? I know there's a bit of a push for it in the UK. We've slowly but surely things have changed, haven't they, from signing credit card chitties to chip and PIN to signing for your by your credit card to chip and PIN, now to these kind of contactless cards, which everyone has just been given. I mean, the whole technology has been changed. Nobody really has been asked. But what's happening with electronic cash in Hong Kong?
Hong Kong is traditionally a very cash place. People work, have cash, like to buy things in cash, like to trade in cash. But what's happening, again, because back to the Lee Ka Sing factor, he also owns a lot of supermarkets in Hong Kong. There's probably about three families that control all the major supermarkets in Hong Kong. And all these supermarkets now are saying, if you spend the equivalent of £50 and you use your credit card, you will get £5 back. But if you use a smartphone, you'll get £8 knocked off your bill. So there's a massive incentive to try to get people to use electronic
payments. They're doing a similar thing here in Bristol with the buses, where if you pre-buy your tickets or if you use some app on the phone which steals all your data for first group who run the buses, then you're getting a cheaper bus ticket than if you use cash. I mean, this surely, though, is just because there are costs involved to all businesses in handling cash, whereas electronic money is much easier for them to handle.
When I was younger, if you used to go to somewhere and say, hey, any discount for cash, and these are established organisations, they say, yeah, sure, you get a discount for cash because people want it cash.
Well, that was because it didn't go through the books often. It was just, it didn't actually go and get taxed, for example.
I think not always. I mean, some places would do, because if you use a credit card, the credit card company would charge a percentage for collecting that money from the retailer or the seller. And therefore, if you gave him cash, you didn't have to pay that percentage. I think was part of the deal. But also with electronic payments, where if you use an electronic payment and you park your car in a car park, and you can say you've paid so much money in a supermarket or anywhere in that shopping mall, you'll get 3 hours free parking. But if you pay by cash, you have to pay $60 or £6 to park your car for 3 hours. So the incentive game is on in town. And my guess would be that once you've got rid of the cash, the incentive will no longer apply.
No, you're probably right. I mean, is there a bigger agenda, do you think, with electronic cash?
Oh, the electronic cash game, talk about all day about this one. The electronic cash game is about monitoring exactly what people do, what they spend, and you've got total control over them. Also, if you no longer have cash and you really annoy the system, they can stop you buying things. They can stop you. They can say, sorry, you've got so many points now on your negative credit. You've crossed too many roads and it's been a red man at the Pelican Crossing. Sorry, you can only spend so much now on food, or you can only. It gives people more control over you. This is also, the electronic cash is also done through fear factor. Another big topic is international law. And when you have international laws, if you have international law, those laws control a country from outside the country. And more now we've got anti-money laundering legislation. It's actually called anti-money laundering and terrorism legislation. The fear put into people being terrorism, that moving money around causes problems. Therefore, they have to monitor more detail about your bank accounts and everything that you go and do. And if it's a large amount of money, it's flagged up as a suspicious transaction, and people can then close your account, start investigating your account, and make your life very difficult.
I mean, this sounds to me like a sort of Big Brother society being created. Not, I'm sure it's not just in Hong Kong, across much of the Western world. How's China getting on with all of this? I mean, are they cash friendly, or are they also on a push to electronic money? Because I know in India, for example, they had a massive push for electronic money, and they're trying to literally ban cash. They took loads of the high denomination notes out of circulation in India. So what's the situation in China?
it depends where you are. If you're in the major cities in China, it's just about all electronic payment, very little cash. But in the smaller places, people still use the cash. So you can see that in these major commercial centres now, it's virtually all electronic.
I suppose people
cash.
Think that it's quicker and easier, don't they? And they don't really think exactly. about the other implications. Anyway, whereabouts are all these policies coming from in Hong Kong? I'd just like to know where, you know, because it doesn't sound to me as if they're going to the people and saying, what do you want? They're not. They're just saying, this is the way it's going to be. But who is saying that? Who's developing these policies?
Certain organisations, this is my view of it, they can freely move around the world, that have influence, resources, wealth, and a network, are the real people driving this policy. And these people are in organisations like universities, particularly London School of Economics, Oxford, and University College London. And I think, according to the Daily Mail, those three universities were at Bilderberg. That's what I read in the Daily Mail. Charity institutions, green groups, and the British consulate and other consular offices. These have offices and networks in many different countries, and they're highly influential. University networks, hugely, hugely powerful. For example, in Hong Kong, one of the professors at University College London was able to give a talk to all the judges on why AI, artificial intelligence, should be used in the judiciary to actually make judgments in a more effective way than judges making judgments, and that everybody should be using AI to settle legal disputes.
I mean, is there an argument for that? It might be quicker and cheaper to do it that way.
True, it may well be quicker and cheaper, but again, you've got the problem. Once you take the human element out of it and the person that sets that computer controls the overall result.
Some people would say that actually taking the human factor out of it might be a good thing. It might make for more impartial decisions.
For me, my preference for law would be to have an open court with a jury every time and be judged by your peers, rather than by a judge, and least of all by a robot. I'm not a fan of that, because I think a jury takes into account not just the law, but a broader list of factors in reaching a decision. And I think they tend to reach, my view, better decisions than just judges on their own.
Have you had a wave of austerity in Hong Kong and that part of the world like we've had in Europe? Because that was, it's been, I mean, particularly horrendous for people who are low paid, etc. in Europe. It's caused such a problem that it, you know, it's starting to lead possibly to the breakup of the Brussels European Union, etc. I just wondered, have you had that wave of austerity over there, where it is enormous cuts to the public sector?
We haven't had cuts, no. I mean, the China economy, the mainland China economy, I think the last time I looked at it was growing about 6.8%, pretty healthy economic growth. And Hong Kong's growing at around 4% a year. The problem with Hong Kong is massively rising property prices, which wages have not kept up with. So people can't buy a property. For example, 600 square foot apartment is going to cost you about 1.2 million British pounds. And that's not in Central, that's out in Zheung Guan Au. That's a huge amount of money. Few people can afford property. So that eats, there's not been cuts, but the fact that the cost of things has increased means that people are worse off and wealth gaps are increasing.
Okay, well, what's your prediction, your crystal ball on the Hong Kong National Party? Will they survive the month?
Gosh, probably no. They're not a particularly big party. They don't have that many members. And there are other alternatives which have very similar, but rather than calling themselves independents, they talk about self-determination parties. And those two parties, Dem and Sisto, which is again run by students, is a far stronger party. I think the Hong Kong National Party, it's just not got any resources and it's unlikely to survive. I don't think it will survive.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Alison Weir. I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit organization in the U.S. called If Americans Knew. It's a journalistic organization to give Americans the facts on Israel and Palestine and about especially the American connection.
Can you just talk us through the way that the relationship between the United States policy and Israel has changed over the decades?
I'd be glad to. It's done nothing, as you suggest, but really get closer and closer. What many people don't know, and certainly most, almost no Americans know, is that the movement for Israel became very active in the United States back in the late 1800s. That's when political Zionism began really everywhere. Most people, or at least many people, have heard of Theodore Herzl, who's considered the father of political Zionism, the movement that ultimately created Israel. But at the same time, and allied, very connected to that movement, was activism within the United States. So we're talking about in the late 1800s, there was already a movement in the U.S. to create a Jewish state in Palestine, even though at that time Palestine was fully inhabited and its population was about 95% non-Jewish. It was about 80% Muslim and about 15% Christian, a little under 5% Jewish. So that movement worldwide originally was not really very successful. Most Jews around the world, including within Palestine itself, opposed Zionism. Most Jewish Americans did not become Zionists, and some of them actively opposed Zionism. But the movement nevertheless became powerful by 1910. It was already considered a significant movement by politicians in the U.S., especially in the larger eastern cities. Then in, I think it was around 1914, a prominent American Supreme Court justice, Louis Brandeis, who's very famous. There's a university named after him. He's held in high regard by most Americans, especially those of us that are liberals or progressives, have always respected Brandeis. Well, it turns out that he became the head of World Zionism around 1914 or so. And then he was appointed to the Supreme Court by Woodrow Wilson. When you become a member of the Supreme Court, the normal behavior is to resign your board affiliations and your connections to various organizations because you're supposed to be neutral, or at least to be perceived as neutral. So Brandeis officially resigned his leadership of the World Zionist Organization, but a number of books disclose this. He remained its leader for quite a while, and his loyal lieutenants would come into the Supreme Court chambers where Brandeis would give them directives to carry out. This is very little known by most Americans and is really considered highly unethical behavior. Then, to get into more of your question and the aspect of this that would probably be more interesting to English listeners, is that Brandeis became, not only was he the head of World Zionism, but he was a leader in what was, according to an article in a scholarly journal, a peer-reviewed Jewish scholarly journal, he was a leader in a secret Zionist society called the Parashim. Normally, I'm not one who believes or expects to find, quote, secret societies, but this was from the U.S. Jewish Historical Quarterly. It's also discussed in a mainstream book by a highly regarded author named Peter Gross, who was at the New York Times for many years, then at Harvard, wrote a number of nonfiction books. So I discovered this connection that Brandeis had to that society. And then reading from Dr. Sarah Schmidt, who's an Israeli professor, and Peter Gross, the American who used to be the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, write that a leader of the Parashim, a man named Horace Kallen, who was a professor first at Princeton, then at the University of Wisconsin, came up with the idea of suggesting to the British that they would gain a benefit from announcing a policy in support of Zionism, of creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This idea was suggested by Professor Kallen, an American, and made its way to Britain through various intermediaries in 1915. Now, at that time, Britain really had nothing to do with Palestine. Palestine at that time was under the Ottoman Empire. It was not yet under the British Empire, huge as the British Empire was. The sun did set on the British Empire in Palestine because Palestine was under the Ottomans. So why would Kallen suggest that the British would benefit from announcing a policy supporting Zionism? Well, the reason, it turns out, and this is in a number of books. If people get my book, you'll see that it's thoroughly cited. My book is half footnotes, literally. So everything I say, people can look at the source for it. In 1915, as I'm sure we all remember, that was World War I, what was called at the time the Great War. Britain was desperate to have the U.S. come into its side of the war. The first day of battle of the Battle of the Somme, British casualties were about 60,000 men in one day of battle. The problem from Britain's point of view and from the Zionists' point of view, as we'll see later, but from Britain's point of view, was that Americans did not want to enter the, quote, Great War. It had nothing to do with Americans. It was far away and really had really little interest to Americans. Woodrow Wilson was reelected to office with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But as I think I just said, the British government very much wanted the U.S. to come in on their side of the war. The Zionist leadership in Britain, especially a man named Chaim Weizmann, who later became president of Israel, went to the British government, and he made the claim that he and his colleagues in the U.S., and he especially referred to Brandeis, who was at that time in the Supreme Court and a good friend of Woodrow Wilson, he claimed that through Brandeis and other colleagues in the U.S., they could influence the U.S. to join the war on the side of Britain. And they said that they would do that if Britain would promise that it would then facilitate their efforts to have a Jewish state in Palestine. This is in a number of books, and it was referred to as the Gentleman's Agreement. This is how the Zionists, Israel partisans, although it wasn't yet Israel, so we have to use the political term, which is Zionists, managed to obtain this declaration. Mild as it is, really, in some ways, it opened the door to colonization of Palestine by Jewish immigrants and colonists. This is how they obtained the Balfour Declaration. And another very interesting aspect of it that, again, most of us didn't know, but it seems to be corroborated in a number of books, is that the actual author of the declaration was not Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister at the time. It was actually a secret Zionist named Leopold Amory. Again, this came out from a Jewish historian who's very eminent Jewish historian, wrote about this in an article that I first read in the San Francisco Jewish Bulletin, and in a more extensive article and elsewhere, he goes into more detail about Leopold Amory and his secret connections to Zionism and how much he worked so on behalf of Zionism within the British government. And he was the one that authored the final wording of what's called the Balfour Declaration. But that wording had previously, before it was finalized by Amory, it had gone back and forth between Britain and the United States. Zionists in the United States had helped draft what's called the Balfour Declaration. That's how the U.S. played a major role and was used by Zionists to ultimately create Israel, because the Balfour Declaration, even though I for many years did not consider it very major because what it states is not very strong, really. But when you crack a door open, then it's pretty easy to push it open the rest of the way. And that's basically what the Balfour Declaration did. But at that time, still most Americans, including the large majority of Jewish Americans, were not yet Zionists. We're talking about a small but very fanatic group that already had managed to obtain quite a bit of funding. It was at that time starting to already get some funding from some banking families, such as the Schiff family. The Rothschild family was providing funding to political Zionism. So it had already become a major player worldwide in 1915 and basically in 1917 when the Balfour Declaration was formally issued.
What about, you mentioned banking, what about Lord Rothschild, Lionel Rothschild, I believe? The Balfour Declaration was actually written to him.
It was. That also is usually left out when people talk about the Balfour Declaration. I think the attempt is, and it's largely successful, is to make this seem like a high-level, well-thought-out British policy. But this was a policy, this was written to Lord Rothschild, who is another Zionist leader. So here we have a declaration authored by a secret Zionist, but, again, if people go to my book, it's called Against Our Better Judgment, and read my footnotes and see all the different sources for this. We have a declaration written by a secret Zionist, co-authored and drafted by a number of Zionists, both in Britain and in the United States, and then written to a British Zionist named Rothschild. All of that is normally left out whenever, you read any history of Israel and Zionism, and you'll hear about the Balfour Declaration, this will be discussed. But almost never will those important facts be part of the picture.
Sounds like a very long-term project, actually, with a lot of secrecy as well, with the secret society involved. That always helps obscure what it's really about. What's the ultimate aim? Other than the creation of the State of Israel, what was the point? Why put so much effort into this?
Well, I think there will be different views about that. I always go with the I don't jump to conspiracy theories. I really look for facts, and then I look at what those facts show, and often there's a very clear pattern. In this case, the minimum that was being attempted was what they succeeded in achieving was to create a Jewish state in Palestine, to basically steal somebody else's land, kick off the majority of the inhabitants, both Muslims, Christians, and there were a few other groups, kick them off, take over that land, create a nation state that now the rest of the world is told, quote, has the right to exist, which basically is saying somehow they had the right to violently expel the indigenous population, discriminate the remnants of the indigenous population, and become such a powerful nation that they now drive U.S. policies.
Well, hang on, because it's an interesting relationship, a bit like the relationship between the UK as well, the relationship between Israel and the United States. Who wears the trousers in that relationship now?
Israel. This is the part that a lot of people that claim to be Palestine solidarity activists, and many of whom I believe really are, but are reluctant to believe, and certainly extremely reluctant for other people to know, that Israel is the decisive member of this relationship between the U.S. and Israel. It's not surprising that it's hard for some people to believe. Many Jewish activists really just are in denial and don't want to believe it, for sort of because of human nature. I think it's often it's that simple.
Well, what evidence have you got for that, though?
Well, both the historic evidence, because when you look through who pushed this, who succeeded in pushing Zionism, this was done by Jewish groups, by Zionist groups. The State Department, the U.S. State Department, was opposed to it. There were numerous documents, memos, studies, reports, all opposing Zionism. The Pentagon was opposing Zionism for many decades. The Secretary of Defense, Forrestal, opposed Zionism. The intelligence agencies in the U.S. opposed Zionism. All of them wrote detailed memos about how damaging to the U.S. support of Zionism would be. There's a very clear written record of the U.S. establishment opposing Zionism. Christians, some of the most celebrated Christian pastors oppose Zionism. A Dead Sea scholar wrote a very powerful book about the responsibility that Christians had to support Palestinian human rights. So historically, there's a very clear documentary record that this was not being pushed by the usual suspects that often do run things. It was not pushed, surprisingly enough, by the military-industrial group. It was not pushed by the Pentagon. It's quite clear that it was pushed by this very fervent special interest group.
So, I mean, it sounds to me as if you're saying that there is a Jewish conspiracy.
Well, I would be more precise than that, because there were also, during these years, Jewish groups that were opposing it, that were actively speaking out against it. There was it was called the American Council for Judaism, publicly opposed it. Alfred Lilienthal, a Jewish author, wrote a number of excellent books exposing Zionism. There were some rabbis. So a Jewish conspiracy suggests that it was all Jews, and that it was the majority of Jews, at least. It certainly was not all Jews, and it was not a majority of Jews from most of the movement's existence.
What about more up to date, though? I know you've got an action alert out at the moment about more money that seems to be going to Israel from the U.S.
We have now in the U.S. a bill that the U.S. media have not even reported on that's in Congress that would give Israel $38 billion over the next 10 years. That works out to over $23,000 for each Jewish Israeli family of four. Would be getting $23,000 from American taxpayers. This has been introduced into both houses of Congress, both the House of Representatives and the Senate. It passed a committee with a large majority in the Senate already. Only one person objected to that, Rand Paul. And yet, this is not even being reported to the American public.
So how much money... every year, how much money every year goes from the U.S. to Israel?
The number we've been using to make it just sort of a simple round number has been over $10 million per day of American tax money to Israel. And that's the conservative number. That's the official number from the Congressional Research Service. There's additional money on top of that. There's also a much greater cost to Americans. The cost to Americans is at least, and this is even before it's gone up, this new bill makes it even larger, but the cost to the average American or to American taxpayers has been about $15 million per day.
So that works out around about $3.5 or $4 billion a year.
That's right. It goes between $3 and $4 billion per year, and it's been going on for a long time. U.S. taxpayers, unknown to us, we never read about this in our media or hear about it on TV, but American taxpayers have been giving to the tiny state of Israel more of our tax money than we've given to anybody else, than to all the starving countries of Africa put together. In fact, on average, per capita, Israelis get 6,000 times more American money than other people around the world.
Now, you call your charity If Americans Knew. What was it that made you decide to call it that? And how did you come to start it? What drove you to start it?
Well, I started it. It's a very, very simple, clear story. I was like most Americans, I knew almost nothing about Israel-Palestine. I certainly was sympathetic to Israel. I felt that was, quote, our side, I think unconsciously. But then in fall of 2000, when the second Palestinian uprising began, called the Second Intifada, this was in the news a bit, in U.S. news media, and I finally decided at that point in my life to pay attention. I was just curious, what's Israel-Palestine about? When I paid attention to it, my background is journalism, I noticed very quickly that we were getting one-sided reporting. We were getting very pro-Israel reporting. Because the internet had just become available for research, I looked into it further, started to discover that during this time, Israeli forces were killing and injuring very large numbers of Palestinian men, women, and children. And this was being covered up in the U.S. news media, the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, NPR. So after a few months of getting drawn in more and more, the more I looked into it, the more I felt this was the largest cover-up I had ever seen. And, of course, we've seen many. So after a few months, I quit my job. I was the editor of a very small local weekly newspaper, and I traveled over to Gaza and the West Bank in early 2001 as a freelance reporter and saw firsthand what Israel was doing to Palestinians. So when I came back, I started an organization that was to be nonpartisan, non-ideological, and try to give the facts about Israel-Palestine and the U.S. connection to every possible American that we can reach with that information.
Now, some people say that the Israelis are planning a massive war with Iran, which could precipitate Armageddon. Now, there's a sort of inevitability that if that happens, surely that's just all, it's going to be impossible to stop. So what do you say to people like that?
Well, certainly Israel has been targeting Iran for a very long time. And Israel partisans in the U.S., the group of them called neoconservatives, which are largely motivated by their passion for Israel, have Iran in their sights. You know, they wanted to destroy Iraq. The U.S. invaded Iraq on behalf of Israel. Syria has been destroyed largely. And Iran is the major country that Israel partisans want destroyed. I'm actually writing a long article about this right now. From the beginning, Israel realized that it needed to dominate the entire Middle East. It needed to have hegemony in the region. And there were two ways to do that. One was to get money and weaponry from other countries, which they have done. The other is to prevent any other country in the region from becoming sufficiently successful that it could challenge Israel and that it could successfully advocate for Palestinian human rights. Iran is the one that's left. Pretty much everybody else has either been bought off or destroyed. So Iran is left. And so far, they have succeeded in a great deal. There has not been a full-out military attack, although they have done a number of violent attacks on Iran. They've assassinated some young Iranian scientists, and they've gotten the U.S. and the rest of the world to have a blockade against Iran, which is really, I believe, according to international law, an act of war already.
Do you think Netanyahu and the Israeli government are going to get their war with Iran?
I think that they're hoping that the U.S. will damage Iran so badly that they can keep their hands clean and not lose any Jewish lives. My book is entitled Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. Our website is ifamericansknew.org, and we also have a blog that we post to every day. So if people go to ifamericansknew, our main website, you can also find there the link to the blog, which has new information being posted every day.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you want at dialectradio1word.co.uk. hongkongnow.uk. Thanks to our guests, Robert Hansen from Hong Kong, and also Alison Weir from the charity If Americans Knew. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.